Approaching the primary, we talk turnout, apathy, and ask whether a Durham congressman should have endorsed. It's the Politics Podcast from WUNC. Glad to have you along. Final Friday before that May 17th voting day. And it's time to chat about the partisan contests and also the contents of the governor's latest budget proposal. And we'll chat about it with Donna King, editor-in-chief at the Carolina Journal and arm of the conservative John Locke Foundation, and Rob Schofield, director of the progressive NC Policy Watch. Good to see you both.
Hey, guys.
Hi.
The May primary, just a few days away. Early voting numbers suggest turnout will be strong, potentially even near midterm record levels. Lots of money, lots of candidates, lots to discuss. Let's begin with the story of this primary as we head toward Tuesday. What is it to you, Donna?
Well, I think, one, exactly what you just said. There's a tremendous voter turnout here in the early days, about 130,000 more ballots than we saw this time in 2018. One of the biggest ones that we see is unaffiliated voters have now passed Democrats and Republicans. They passed the number of Republicans, registered Republicans in North Carolina some time ago. Now they've passed Democrats as well. So we're really watching closely to see which ballot those unaffiliated voters pick up. Right now, in the early days, we're still only about 5% turnout, so it's, you know, you can't really put your money on it now, but right now they're picking up Republican ballots, not quite double the rate of Democrat, but it's getting there. And that's the question. Will that early lead for Republican ballots mean anything when it comes to November?
I guess a couple things occur to me. One is that, well, you know, it's kind of nice that these numbers are high. I mean, let's be real. These numbers are still pathetically low. What do we have? 14% turnout in the last off-term election, 16% before that. We're still looking at, you know, what, one out of six voters ultimately voting. So I'm not like doing cartwheels over the numbers we're seeing. I think, frankly, people have just gotten used to voting earlier and voting, virtually or by mail anyway. So I don't know. I mean, it's fine. I think it would be surprising if we weren't having more Republican ballots picked up, because they've got the high profile race. They've got the U.S. Senate race, and that, you know, those big high profile races tend to drive what turnout there is. But again, I find it kind of disappointing that the numbers are still pretty remarkably low, really, when you look at the big picture.
So to pick up where Rob was just at, meanwhile, young voters appear poised to turn out in lower numbers than usual for this midterm. And spoiler, those historical numbers for young people are not good to begin with. So we're going to flip it here. And I'm not wondering necessarily about the young voters, registered or not, but young folks. I'm wondering about the candidates. Is there anything that candidates could have, should have done differently as we think about courting millennial or Gen Z voters? Or is this kind of an apathy thing that is only going to be solved on their own, translation, when they get older? Rob?
Well, I think part of it to remember, of course, is that North Carolina is actually sort of unusual in that we don't have that much up in these off-year elections. We do have a Senate seat this year, which is, and we do have congressional seats. We don't have all the Council of State races that in a lot of states you would be seeing voted on at this time and are seeing voted on at this time. So, you know, I don't know. I think young people are understandably sort of turned off by a lot of the negative ads. I mean, there really hasn't been very much positive, certainly on a statewide basis, to get you very fired up. Sherry Beasley in the Democratic primary for Senate is trying to run sort of a moderate, progressive, upbeat campaign, but she doesn't really have anybody running against her. So there's not much to really turn out a whole lot of excitement there. And the Republican Donnybrook on the Senate side has been just sort of unpleasant to watch. It's hard to imagine it getting anybody too fired up to vote.
I mean, I would agree with a lot of that. And I think one of the reasons we are seeing a huge uptick in unaffiliated voters is that young voter. A lot of them, perhaps for one reason or another, don't feel like they identify with one party or another and are planning to vote by the issue or by the candidate. If they decide to go vote, you are seeing some efforts among both parties to try and draw that younger voter. But that's something that, you know, elections and candidates have wrestled with for decades. It's not just this time. You see the Democrats really pushing this, forgiving college debt in an effort to draw them. I'm not sure that that's something that's resonating with the majority of Americans. Only about About 65% of Americans did not go to college at all. So that's not something that's really seems to be resonating, although with that young voter, it might bring them out. But you're right. There is an ongoing issue with trying to draw them to the polls. And truthfully, you know, generation after generation, it really becomes as they get older and they have more skin in the game. They're paying more taxes. They have kids in school. That's often what brings them to the polls.
Of course, if North Carolina hadn't done things like do away with pre-registration for voting, which was something that was a part of state law until Republicans repealed it for no good reason as part of the monster voting law earlier this past decade, we might see a little more turnout from young people. It's always sort of mystifying what the Republicans were afraid of if more young people did turn out to vote.
Maybe just a quick note of context here. It is interesting as we think about early voting, it has become such a, I don't know, a regular part of the election day, election lead up nomenclature in our state. I was having a conversation with a political scientist, Chris Cooper of Western Carolina University, earlier this week, and he just reminded me that, hey, you know, just eight years ago in the last midterm election in which there was a U.S. Senate race, people didn't really use early voting at anywhere near the prevalence that they do now. So it's a relatively new thing in our state. I offer that as of nothing, but just a reminder, this is not something that's been around for decades. So focusing on these U.S. House races, there are several congressional elections which are open. In the first, G.K. Butterfield is retiring. In the fourth, David Price is retiring. In the 13th, which has now moved geographically, Ted Budd is running, of course, for that nomination on the Republican side in the U.S. Senate contest. And then there's the 14th, which is a new seat, so, of course, there's no incumbent. I want to ask you each about the fourth here just for a moment or two. Durham anchors the fourth. It's a cluttered slate of progressives. Endorsements have been flying about. A lot of money, millions and millions. It's been reported that this will be the most expensive U.S. House race in state history. Money's been flying about, a lot of it coming in from out of state. I mentioned endorsements. However, the outgoing congressman, David Price, did not endorse in this race. Should he have? Rob?
Yes, that's up to him. I mean, if there's nobody there that he, you know, feels is superior, or maybe he feels that they're all equally impressive candidates, or at least they're equal enough that they don't deserve anyone to be selected on his part. I mean, I think the thing that I've been struck by lately, of course, is the controversy surrounding Senator Fauci and the sort of excitement maybe that seems to sort of be creeping into Nita Allam's campaign, which is someone who probably wouldn't have predicted to emerge from this, but in a race in which there are so few people really ultimately going to make the decision, if we have 15 or 16% turnout, a small number of very committed voters can make a difference. I was struck by, she seems to be starting to attract more endorsements and perhaps developing a little momentum.
I agree. I think that Nita Allam's presence in that race has made it a lot more interesting. She's gotten a lot of attention. But Valerie Fauci has brought in a lot more money. They're both running kind of similar campaigns, but you see a lot more of Nita Allam's support. She's a Muslim candidate and has had some of the same positions that Republicans and even some of the middle of the road voters have been concerned about the squad, that maybe the next member of the squad might come from Durham. I think she has a strong support among progressive, regardless of who she might align herself if she were to win and to win that race. Valerie Fauci, though, has got a strong presence in North Carolina and in her district. So her support has been pretty broad. But you're right, this is a really important race. Both candidates have said Medicaid for all. They've both said parts of the Green New Deal. So I think they're both in step with that progressive platform.
Well, and they know that David Price was in that seat for a very long time, effectively the equivalent of that seat. I know the districts get redrawn, but I mean, there's a good chance that whoever wins this race has an opportunity to serve in Congress for a very extended period, especially if it were Nita Allam, who's pretty young. So it's a position that could become important. It's a seat that could become important over time. Finding those high profile seats attached to important cities and institutions like UNC that a candidate, a member of Congress could serve for a very long time. Those are hard to find. So it's understandable that people are attracted to such a race.
Early voter or primary day? When are you all casting your ballots?
I already have.
We're going to go primary morning.
Anything else on primary that's kind of percolating for either of you right now?
I think one of the things that has struck me about this particular primary is, and this has happened before, it's not new really, but particularly this time, we've got one competitive congressional district, and so that means that this primary is critical. And speaking again to that idea of voter turnout, I'm not positive that voters, most voters, except for those of us who are way in the weeds on it, realize that, you know, this really is, in many cases, going to pick who wins the general.
I mean, really, if you look at Ted Budd, here's a man who is on the verge of becoming, you know, a very formidable candidate for the United States Senate, is a man who won a primary in which there were a million candidates, and he eked out a very small vote in a very low turnout primary, but he's turned it into a very, you know, a high profile political career. That's how politics really unfortunately works these days. If you get elected or if you run in the right race, even a small turnout election can launch a career.
Governor Cooper rolled out his budget proposal this week. To a degree, it's a symbolic proposal that the state's executive puts forth. It is the first pass in the spending plan debate, which can take months or years around these parts. Unsurprisingly, Cooper seeks to appropriate more money than what we expect Republican legislative leaders to put forth. The state is projected to have something north of $6 billion cash on hand by early summer. Rob, at times in recent years when we've had these budget conversations, you've been underwhelmed with what Cooper has proposed. Was this overly modest, or does it propose enough, in your opinion?
Well, I mean, there's some wonderful stuff in it. So much of it is, of course, long overdue. It's a tragedy that we're still having to talk about Medicaid expansion that should have been done years ago. It's a tragedy that we're talking about Leandro. These basic investments in creating a constitutional education system in our state should have been years ago. They probably still won't get done, even though the governor's calling for them. I think a lot of progressives, you know, appreciate that Cooper is trying to, you know, be moderate and trying to work with Republicans by proposing a budget, you know, that has aspects to it that he probably would change if it were completely up to him. That said, I think many progressives would like to see him out there sort of, you know, swinging more for the fences, being more of a fighter. Things like repealing this nonsense, these nonsensical corporate tax cuts we've been imposing and enacting in recent years, and flattening of our state income tax so that the rich no longer even come close to paying a fair share. Those are the kinds of changes we've made in recent years that if we had a sane state fiscal policy, we would be moving to reverse, and a responsible governor would be proposing to reverse. I guess, you know, Cooper's a realist. He realizes even the very modest proposals he's made are going to have a tough time making any headway. But, you know, I think there are those who think and wish that we were in a position where the governor could really say what he thinks and do, you know, the right thing, as it were.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are parts of that I would agree with. That we're seeing in this case is a $29 billion recommendations in Cooper's budget's about 8.5% increase. And one of the things that I do like is that some of these things are in recurring front funds, and I think that's an important part of this. I agree that I think that I'd like to see some of the you know, corporate giveaways go away. I think that that means that we should, you know, scale back incentives that pick winners and losers and make sure that any benefits that go to companies go to all companies, like the corporate tax increase. I do like some other things that we're seeing in there, which is, of course, some of the retention bonuses, because I know that our schools and some of our other government agencies are having trouble hanging on to people, particularly after the, you know, chaos that was created by closing down schools. I think it is important that there are a few things that we're going to see coming up with the legislative session. I know we're going to talk about that in just a moment, but with the legislation coming up, the legislative session coming up, we're going to see this committee that's been studying expanding Medicaid and figuring out how to do it in a way that's responsible for North Carolina taxpayers, and to really talk about, you know, what works and what doesn't, and what has worked and what doesn't. And of course, as we know, expanding Medicaid has been a reason that Cooper's given for not signing any budget except one, the most recent, since he's been in office. So I think that we are seeing that Medicaid expansion is probably going to be something that he's going to really demand this time around. The legislature's been studying it. But we're also seeing more money for that he recommends for public safety and schools and mental health training and some of those things that that we do need to see.
Sounds good to me. Yeah, I mean, obviously, I think we need, there are a lot of new investments that we make, everything from K through 12 education, but to pre-K, we need, and he proposes expanding access to pre-K. He's also got some good stuff in there. Lisa Sorgan, NC Policy Watch, did a great summary of some of the environmental programs that Cooper urges us to expand and look at. One little example of a sort of very specific thing, he has $160,000 for what we call a project liaison to collaborate between the Department of Commerce and environmental folks. So because we go out and we recruit these businesses, but then we don't take into account the environmental impact of some of the businesses that tend to have negative impacts, often on low-income and minority neighborhoods. So that's a kind of common sense, very practical solution. That budget has some good stuff in there. I hope it gets a very serious review.
So a year that ends in an even number means a short session at the legislature. That has been the case since, I believe, the late 1970s. Lawmakers are back next week. Don't expect a lot next week. They'll come in the following week, we think, with perhaps a little more heft, perhaps a little more interest in doing something. They're going to be there for, 8 weeks, 4 months, somewhere in between, most likely. We'll get to the budget. We'll get to the budget later this spring and later this summer. Donna mentioned the $60 billion, and I'm kidding there. I don't know if it's actually $60 billion. The giant elephant in the room, which is Medicaid expansion. I'm just testing the waters here, gauging the waters. Does Medicaid expansion in North Carolina finally happen this summer? Yes or no? And why or why not? Donna, we'll start with you.
Sure. Of course, we've talked about this a little bit, but there has been a committee of lawmakers, a bipartisan committee that's been studying it through the break. I think that in some form or fashion, something does happen. A couple of the things that are becoming roadblocks is that when Medicaid expansion first started happening, there were waivers in place where you could have a volunteer or work requirement, a little skin in the game with a copay, those kind of things. Those waivers are not being approved by the Biden administration. So I think that that's going to have a difficult time winning over some of the folks on the side, on Republican side, who say we need to have some sort of work requirement or volunteer requirement or copay or something to bring people in, because we're talking about 700,000 or so new people into the system. There's also a lot of folks that are concerned about not just providing the care, but also removing some of those barriers that are creating a situation where they just can't access it. They can't get an appointment, whether it's, con laws or scope of practice or things that are preventing folks that who may then have coverage, who may be part of that Medicaid expansion population, but they can't get an appointment because some of those practitioners are not able to take on new patients. So there's a lot of triggers that are going to be throughout the process they really have to look at. It's not just flipping a switch.
I desperately hope that Donna's right, that this is finally the year. We know that thousands of North Carolinians are dead unnecessarily because we have not expanded Medicaid over the last decade. If anybody has any doubts about the nature of the people who would benefit from this, they should read the op-ed that Dr. Stephen Luking wrote in the Greensboro News and Record a couple of weeks ago, which just, it's just heartbreaking stories of the people that he has tried to serve in his practice, who people who had COVID, people who had cancer, who, just went away and died because they just didn't have any money to pay for healthcare. And even though he was doing his best to provide it for free, the overwhelming majority of people who would benefit from Medicaid expansion are hardworking people. They're working at 2 and 3 jobs. They're disproportionately women. It's just a travesty that we have wasted all this time. We've known for years, and we've known that if we had brought all this federal money in, we'd have a lot more rural hospitals that would be available to provide the care. We'd have shorter waiting lists. We'd have the kind of resources in our healthcare system that would make it, much more accessible for people. So I pray that this is the year that it happens, but I don't know. I've been disappointed before. I'm not getting my hopes up too high.
Donna, a final word or no?
No, I mean, I think that there are a lot of things that there was a lot of discussion. We had John Kasich, who from Ohio, who came into one of the committee meetings. One of the things I found interesting, we've been watching a lot of these committee meetings over the legislative break. We heard a lot from folks in other states who expanded it, who talked about how great it was. In the vast majority of cases, those folks took advantage of the waivers that were available, and they just aren't available anymore. So what Medicaid looks like there may not be what Medicaid looks like here. And North Carolina went through a transformation of Medicaid and how it's managed, and that I'm sure hopefully would make it a little bit easier to manage if that were the case. But I think that there are a lot of things to still study and a lot of things that need to be considered when we really look at beyond just providing that card, that Medicaid card, but actually getting people in the doctor's office and in front of a practitioner.
Rob Schofield is director of NC Policy Watch. Donna King is editor-in-chief at the Carolina Journal. Enjoy your weekends.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys. Take care.
Earlier this week on the Politics Podcast, former Capitol Hill staffer Doug High and political scientist Chris Cooper talked about the power of incumbency and what it has taken in the past to oust a sitting member of Congress. Have a listen, please, if you've yet to do so. And next week, we'll be giving you updates on some of those congressional races that you've heard a lot about in this space. Congressman Cawthorn also opened districts in the 1st, the 4th, the 13th. The 14th technically is open as well. Anyway, lots happening next week. Do hope that you'll be paying attention to it by listening to our other podcast, Tested, this program, and maybe have a visit or three to our website, wunc.org. Do hope that you enjoy that weekend. Talk to you again soon.